So I realize it's the end of the day, and everyone is obviously pretty tired and heading towards a firewall, so I'll be brief and hopefully exciting. So on the schedule, I'm just given as talking about ACT parameter constraints, but I thought, given all the discussions, I would kind of rephrase it. I was going to say the small-scale CMB and why you care, but I'll just make it why what it means for you. And so I'll talk about some of the results from ACT and link them to some of the results that you will have already seen from Planck, and then just give you a bit of a flavor for things that we are doing and things that we're looking at to do in the future. So I'm part of the Atacama Cosmology Telescope collaboration, and the work that I'll be discussing is summarized in these papers that we put out at the beginning of the year and other ones on small-scale, other small-scale results. Okay, so we know that we have the temperature of the CMB that we decompose into spherical harmonics, and we use those the coefficients of that expansion as the CLs. Fantastic. We understand how to treat things, and the great thing that we always need to stress about the CMB is that because it's coming from this early time, the physics is linear, we have well-understood Boltzmann codes that help us go from parameters into power spectra, angular power spectra, and they give us really the wealth of information. And so you will have seen in March this just fantastic plot. I love to show it because it just reminds me, exactly as Dick told us at the beginning of Monday morning, that theories may be interesting and ugly at the moment, but the data are really beautiful. And so it's good to keep in mind. However, you don't realize that there are subtle uglinesses in the data, and that's what makes a data analysis so exciting as well. So other than the fact that cosmologists have changed their color schemes in the last 20 years, you'll see that we've really come, in the 20 years since COBE, we've really come a long way. COBE had a resolution of 7 degrees, and so the primordial CMB fluctuations, which we expect to vary on the scale of about a degree, really, we really needed to wait for experiments post-COBE to analyze the anisotropy structure. And various groups did that. Most notably, the WMAP satellite allowed us to really pin down the spectrum to a very high degree of precision, and Planck has come in and really given us a lot more information. So why do I have a job then? Because Planck has given us such great results, but it's important to realize that the small-scale experiments on the ground, such as ACT and SBT, really take it that one step further. So now we have resolutions of about 1.5 arc minutes, depending on the frequency that we observe in. And so we now measure not only the underlying primordial fluctuations, but really a wealth of other information from sources between us and the CMB. So we've been Google Earthed. This is the Atacama Cosmology Telescope in the deserts of northern Chile, and it's operating. The ACT itself has stopped taking data, but I'll discuss briefly at the end the next phase, which is really exciting. And ACT operated until 2010 in 3 frequency bands designed to capture information about the Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect, which comes about because we have the CMB photons interacting with galaxy clusters. Okay. So if you actually look, this is a fantastic plot. If you look at this Planck map at 143 gigahertz and compare it, as Amir Hajian has done, to the ACT map, you'll see that not only do we see the same underlying structure, which is really neat just to see in a two-dimensional image, but we also see other things. So you should see a bright radio galaxy, which is shown as a hot spot. It's giving off emission. But then also we see these Sunyaev-Zeldovich clusters, which either appear as cold spots at low frequencies below the Sunyaev-Zeldovich null, or as kind of hot spots in the CMB at higher frequencies. You can actually compare them statistically as well. And so this is a cross-correlation of the ACT data in the southern patch. So we observe in an equatorial patch and in the south. And if we cross-correlate our maps with the Planck maps, where we've degraded our maps to the Planck resolution, you see that we have pretty good agreement, which is reassuring because, of course, we know we should be seeing the same underlying CMB sky. Okay. So where does ACT give us information? The key point is that a lot of the parameters they'll be discussing and presenting to you are really affecting the silk damping tail. So this, of course, is L to the fourth CL, which is a slightly different representation that allows you really to see these peaks. And we probe the third to the seventh peak, and so you can start to see deviations, or you can start to test for deviations from the standard kind of concordance cosmology model. For example, things like running of the spectral index, ineffective, and the primordial helium abundance really change the silk damping scale. That's the take-home, one of the take-home messages of the talk. When you are looking at very small scales, you very quickly become dominated by foreground emission. And so while I won't go into a lot of the details of exactly how we do all of that, I'll just briefly sketch it, it's really important to understand, model, and characterize your foreground emission, because they can have non-negligible effects on cosmological parameters inferred. And that's why the small scales really help us. A lot of the times in Planck papers, you'll see, for example, some of the parameters are Planck plus high L, and it's essential, the high L is really essential to understand your foreground models. And you can see that just by looking at the data at multiple frequencies. So, you know, everything is kind of agreeing at low L. There's a sort of sweet spot where you get a lot of cosmology from the silk damping scale, but you're not yet dominated by foregrounds. And then on the smallest scales at the largest multiples, you really notice the sources start to lift. And in fact, you can see this is 148 gigahertz, the cross spectrum between 148 and 220 gigahertz, and the 220 gigahertz spectrum. And here you can actually see a model of all the components that we add up together to really model that small-scale power. In case you want the details, this is the only slide on the foregrounds that I'll really show. We model the total CMB as a underlying primordial fluctuations, which is what you would get out of your Boltzmann code, and that's really what's sensitive to all your cosmology. And then secondary emission, which comes from Sunyaev-Zeldovich sources, the kinematic SZ effects, the clustered infrared galaxies, so the CIB, and the correlation between those two radio sources and emission from the galaxy. And so all of that comes together. You can see the different frequency dependence of the sources helps us to try and understand the relation and model them really well. And these bands are what we put on the constraints on the emission. Most notably, of course, there's this dip here you see in the SZ emission, that it's strong at low frequencies, and then there's a null where we expect no SZ emission. Okay, so if you are more interested in the underlying primordial cosmological parameters, what we've done with ACT is we've actually presented a marginalized likelihood. So we estimate all the, rather than estimating all the parameters, we marginalize out over them and Gibbs sampled the CMBCLs themselves, so that when you come to run your favorite cosmological model, you in fact only need to fit to these red data points rather than going out all the way to the full data set and including the foregrounds. Of course, you need to restrict your L range a lot because you can only really do this fitting in the area where your CMB is relatively Gaussian. And given that it falls so strongly, you can't really go above L of about 3,500. But this, if you're interested in testing cosmological models, this of course reduces your computational time significantly because now you're estimating 6 rather than 19 different parameters. Okay, so we've had some talk about various things that we're sensitive to, and one of the dominant things that we test with ACT is ineffective, the effective relativistic degrees of freedom. So again, as I it bears repeating that ineffective is saying, okay, what if we have some extra relativistic energy density at early times? It could be that we have a massless sterile neutrino. It could be that we have some kind of dark radiation. All we're really sensitive to is the energy density of that component, and so we give it the kind of catch-all name of ineffective. And what ineffective really does is that it damps power on the smallest scales because you're basically trading off the silk damping scale and the sound horizon. And the balance of that gives you damping on small scales. So this is from a paper by Amenia Calabrese, myself, and the rest of the collaboration, where we estimated using WMAP9 data, ACT data, and SBT, the best kind of pre-Planck constraints. So this came out just before the Planck data. And you see that we're consistent with ineffective of 3. So ineffective of 3.04, 6 is, of course, the standard case where we just have 3 neutrino species. The reason why this caused a stir, it's always good to put things in context. When we initially looked at our data in 2010 now, we noticed that there was a slight preference for larger ineffective, and this got everyone very excited. As the data have progressed, error bars have gone down and the Central Valley has moved down as well. So now we have a value that's completely consistent with 3. If you want to know what Planck has done, Planck tightens that bound a little bit. So the error bars, this is the Planck constraint. Of course, a lot of the results that you'll see, as I said before, have Planck plus high L as well. Importantly, there's this degeneracy between ineffective and the scalar spectral index. Because, of course, if you're damping out power by having more kind of relativistic energy density, then you can compensate for that by changing your spectral index. And so they will all be very degenerate. Again, you see these black contours. We're perfectly consistent with 3-ish, and Planck really narrows that down a lot, which is reassuring to see and pretty impressive. We could say, let's decide to check now for the mass of the neutrino. So in this case, I've assumed that all the extra relativistic energy density, of course, everything's just massless, but we can say, let's actually test for some preference for our mass of neutrino. Now, a massless neutrino has a temperature of around 0.17 eV at the last scattering surface. So we're only really sensitive to massive neutrinos that are going to change. All they're doing is actually changing the expansion rate of the early universe. The most sensitive test in because of this is actually through measurements of large-scale structure and through the lensing of the CMB, because lensing is actually probing the geometry and not only just the kind of expansion rate of the universe. The other effect, of course, and this is something that ACT is not really sensitive to, is that by changing the expansion rate, if you assume that the universe is flat, you you generate an integrated Sachs-Wolf term, which we don't really, we're not that sensitive to with ACT. And so our constraints were basically just that we limit the mass of the neutrino, the sum of the masses of the neutrinos, to be 0.3 eV. And again, Planck has reduced that, as you can see by the dashed black curve. There are some results which seem to indicate a slight preference for a massive neutrino rather than just an upper bound, but it's always really important when you interpret those constraints as well to realize that there are many degeneracies at play here, particularly with sigma 8 as well. So again, you can think of sigma 8 wants to increase the amplitude of fluctuations, and the massive neutrino would decrease that. Yes? Exactly, it's 0.045 eV, exactly. And so, yeah, so that's what we put the kind of nominal standard picture. In our runs, we allowed the mass to go all the way to zero, but you'll actually notice in the Planck results and the results from the South Pole Telescope, they actually put a lower bound as well at 0.06. So, yeah. Great, okay. So, another degeneracy that, of course, is intimately linked to the fact that we have ineffective change in the expansion rate, if we include that as a parameter, is to the primordial helium. You can think at what changes if you have extra relativistic energy density, you're changing the expansion rate, which means you're changing the temperature, which means you're changing just how these various parameters come out. And if you take out, for example, if you have a larger primordial helium fraction, you're effectively removing electrons from your plasma, and so you're changing, again, the damping. So there's always a degeneracy between these two parameters. Now, you can say, I have pretty good constraint on the primordial helium fraction from BBN, which is a function of ineffective. So in the plot on the right-hand side, on the left-hand side, we actually say, well, let's fix ineffective based on whatever primordial helium we set, so using this relationship, and then you see a pretty a great constraint on the primordial helium fraction, whereas the two-dimensional contours that you see are saying, rather than fixing this relationship from the BBN constraints, let's actually allow both to vary at the same time. So this is given by this kind of degeneracy line, and if we let them free, we don't see any tension. So we are supporting what is already known about the primordial helium constraints. And just for reference, again, this is the Planck number. These two are not completely independent because Planck used some of the high L data to constrain that. Okay, inflation. We've heard a lot about inflation in the last few days, and it's, of course, very exciting. And I wanted to just reiterate something that was said earlier about where we're going with inflation and, in fact, what small-scale measurements can do. You can see by this plot that, okay, we're constraining the NSR degeneracy a lot better than something like WMAP7, for example, but this is largely to the fact that we're constraining NS better. Of course, we don't, you know, we're not measuring anything on large scales, but there is this degeneracy. So if you add power from gravitational waves, you can compensate that. You have a lever arm through NS that you can use to compensate the small-scale power. So the fact that we constrain NS better means we're pushing in from this direction, and that helps break this degeneracy. So we had a measurement of R less than 0.19, and Planck has since refined that to R less than 0.1, which is pretty, which you can see there. So those are just the Planck constraints. And it's pretty amazing to see that we're really narrowing in on this parameter space. Similarly, you can test for running. We find completely consistent results with no real preference for running. Again, there were slight hints of this in our first release, but the data now seem to support kind of more of a simple vanilla model. And if you can rotate your eyes, I couldn't flip the image, so Planck has different scales. You see, in fact, that while we were consistent at 2 sigma with 1, Planck has really changed that, and the preference for scale invariance is really gone, which is exciting to see. Now, this just echoes something that Martin talked to us about today. The fact is, you can say, okay, I don't see any preference for running in the standard picture, but what if I don't want to just assume one model plus running? What if I want to just search for some sort of feature in the inflationary primordial power spectrum? And so we can, Planck has done this, and Martin presented those results today. We actually did it with ACT as well. And again, the reason why you do so much better than the blue squares, which are WMAP, is that we can push to smaller scales with ACT. So we kind of do better in this region and going out here before we start to be dominated by foreground emission. Unsurprisingly, perhaps, otherwise you would have heard about it, we didn't see strong evidence for any feature. And we don't see the kind of feature at L of 1800 that Planck has seen. So we don't, this is results that, not the most, the latest ACT data release, but we don't see any feature particularly. Dan, I believe, is going to talk about this briefly, but what you can do then, if you have a measurement of this primordial power from the CMB, again, this is linear, so you don't have to worry about any sort of nonlinearities. You can just grow that primordial power using standard transfer function and growth, which is fixed by your cosmology. And you can grow that into a matter power spectrum today from the CMB. In fact, if you can then turn that into a mass variance, and you can put it so the CMB points are the brown stars on this curve. And this allows you to really picture the mass variance in the universe across a wide range of scales, in fact, 10 orders of magnitude, going all the way from Lyman alpha data through with clusters and ACT data. There's SDSS measurements here as well. And so really we're probing a huge range of scales. One of the things I like most about this plot is that the dashed line is in no way a fit to the data. So I just fit my data using ACT, took all the other measurements from other surveys, and plotted the lambda CDM curve. So you can see we're doing pretty well, even though we're testing for these deviations from standard physics, we're doing pretty well in our global, simple picture of the universe. Okay, so there have been these discussions on kind of signatures for inflation, and so we know that we've come pretty far along this direction, and we really are gonna have to wait for B-modes before we bring down this direction much further. Then this is a very exciting thing, and there are many experiments in the running, really, to try and detect BMODs and to try and understand what this tells us about our inflation, what we might expect. Given that there was a question about it today, I thought I would literally just flash this up. I'm not a member of the SPIDER collaboration, but this is an experiment which is launching in December, so it's quite exciting and sexy. SPIDER will have roughly 5 times the instrument sensitivity of Planck, they have 120-day balloon flights this December, which will measure large-scale BMODs at 94 gigahertz, and then they have another one planned for next year to do it at 150 gigahertz. And the constraints that they predict are that they'll get to R of about 0.03. The important caveat here is the difference between the solid lines and the dashed lines. So there are, and our understanding of foregrounds will really need to, we need to get that right, because the constraints depend strongly on those, on our understanding of foregrounds. So this is exciting stuff, and you should check it out. It's a large collaboration. The reason why I know about it, of course, is that there are people at Princeton who are leading the work, but it's a multi-institution collaboration. So what if we measure R to be very small? Can we actually say anything with current data about inflation? It turns out we think you can. So this is a paper that I am working on, have put out, and we're following up with actual data with David Marsh here at PI and Dan Grin at the Institute for Advanced Study and Pedro Ferreira in Oxford. And if we say, okay, let's consider that there is an ultralight axion, so we have it ranging in mass between sort of 10 to the minus 22 and 10 to the minus 33 EV. Thank you. If we constrain the amplitude of fluctuations and we measure the isocurvature of the axion, we can actually put constraints on the energy scale of inflation. Now, you will have seen from papers like Planck constraints on the isocurvature from axions and some bounds then on H inflation given your prescription for FA. But of course, this is always assuming that the axions make up all of the dark matter, because if you don't know that, there's a degeneracy there. However, with axions, there are actually signatures that they leave in both large-scale structure measurements and the CMB that allows you to put a constraint on the amount of axions that you have. And then in that way, you can start to break the degeneracy and really learn something about the energy scale of inflation. I'm running out of time, so I won't go through this in too much detail, but this kind of U is data that is constraints that are currently allowed. Everywhere else is ruled out, and the colored in parts are models that satisfy current bounds on R and alpha. And so really, we're starting to narrow down the region of parameter space, and we can put some interesting constraints there. So look out for that coming up soon. We're doing this with small-scale CMB data and other things. Okay, so we have a lot of information that we can get on primordial cosmological parameters just from the CMB itself. But actually, we get information from other things. And so this hasn't really been talked about a lot, and I'll talk about it super briefly. But the gravitational lensing of the CMB is going to be the next, well, it is already the next big thing, but it really provides us with an amazing tool to constrain cosmology. So this is by lensing of the CMB by structures between us and the surface of last scattering. And while the individual deflections are really small, I'm sure you've seen those plots where people wiggle between two and you can almost not see the difference, and they're coherent on scales of a few degrees. And so this is what we use. We actually use an estimator to try and measure that. So ACT did this, the first detection from the CMB only, in 2011, I think was the first paper. We've just put out another one, where we actually measured the deflection power spectrum, which is a function, critically, is a function of both the matter content, but also the geometry of the universe. And so we just parameterized the standard expected lambda cesium value of AL would be 1 if you just predict it from your cosmology. And so you can constrain this amplitude AL. Planck, of course, you know, just did an amazing job of detecting this. I think, given our discussions on odds, I think 25 sigma is actually just a completely crazy number to count, because that means the p-value is like 10 to the minus 137 or something. So we can safely say that Planck has detected gravitational lensing. And again, this is just a really superb measurement showing us that we can start to use this to constrain cosmology, because anything that affects both the geometry or the matter content will change the lensing. This is the lensing map from Planck, and I overheard someone in a Planck talk say that the CMB lensing has now been detected with the same kind of signal to noise of the COBE map. So just think where we'll be in 20 years. So again, why do you care about CMB lensing? Why does it matter at all? You care because you will have probably sat through many cosmology talks where you see this kind of cosmic complementarity plot. The way we constrain our cosmological parameters is by the kind of the fact that these are degeneracy directions are orthogonal, and so you have certain constraints on the dark energy density and the matter density from the CMB and other ones from the supernovae, for example, and they all cross and they give you this tight constraint. And so the argument is that we need independent probes really to beat down on the degeneracies. But what we showed in Sherwin et al. 2011 is actually that the CMB lensing allows you to find evidence for non-zero omega lambda on its own. So we have evidence for dark energy only using the CMB. And you can see that with this plot here. While the CLs for a universe with a lambda CDM universe or a universe where omega lambda is zero, so you're just compensating with curvature, the CMB power spectrum will look the same. The lensing power spectrum looks remarkably different. And so for the first time, we could close these contours and found a 3.2 sigma preference for lambda just using CMB data alone. Okay, I'm rapidly running out of time, but I'll quickly just highlight one or two things that we're doing that are interesting with the actual contaminants, as we like to call them, with the stuff in between us and the surface of last scattering. So I briefly mentioned the Sunyaev-Zoldovich effect. We have CMB photons interacting with hot gas from a cluster. The CMB photons upscatter, and this causes a shift in the frequency spectrum of the CMB photons. Through that, we can detect what we call the thermal Sunyaev-Zoldovich effect. Now you imagine that the cluster itself is moving, and you actually get a boost in these photons, and which is what we call the kinematic Sunyaev-Zoldovich effect. The problem is that the KSZ effect is roughly 20 times smaller than the TSZ effect. And so it's been really hard to try and detect this, even though we know it's an effect that should be there. And so in a paper that we put out in Hand et al. A year ago, we actually measure the fact that clusters on average, if they're close to one another, will be falling in to one another, and if they're far apart, if they're very far apart, they won't be moving at all, they won't be moving relative to each other. So if you look at two clusters along this line of sight, the one closer to you will be moving away from you, and the one further away will be moving towards you. Okay, the way we did this, even though it's a really subtle signal in the CMB, we stacked on galaxy positions so that we could measure this using over 5,000 galaxies. We could actually measure the signal in the CMB. And this is what we found. We found the first detection of the kinematic SZ effect using ACT maps. You can see this bottom plot is what happens when you stack just random positions in the same way. So you're averaging out the effect from the thermal SZ, and you're really just measuring the kind of pairwise momenta of galaxies along the line of sight. And this is a really neat paper. I saw Sunyaev very recently after this came out, and he was beaming in the way that only Sunyaev can beam. Great. Okay, so what's next? I've shown you a few things that we're doing with ACT and that we have already done, but of course, we're always looking forward, and we've talked about polarization a lot. ACT itself won't go after the large-scale B-modes, even though there is a lot of, there's obviously a lot of reason to go for them, and a lot of experiments are doing so. But what we're really be tackling is the lensing, so the E to B mode mixing, which tells you more about things like neutrino mass, neutrino number, and other models of things like dark energy. So this is ACT Pole. The reason why it looks so attractive is that we had a competition where an artist designed the wrapping based on in art inspired by the CMB, so it's been wrapped in an attractive package. And this is ACT Pole just before we actually put it inside the telescope. It's looking its first light, although it's not on the sky. And We had a crazy bout of snow about a week ago, so we've been delayed, but we expect first light actually in the next week or so, which is really exciting. And so ACT-POL will change the game in terms of polarization for a few reasons. So I showed you the plots previously where the foregrounds dominate at large multipoles on small angular scales. And so it's really hard to try and disentangle your secondary emission from the kind of primary CMB emission that you care about. But we expect the foregrounds to be sort of 1 to 2% polarized as opposed to 17% in the temperature only. So they're much less dominant. And you can see that in this, this was actually a forecast for Planck. So these are the kind of current suite of data sets, and these are the Planck error bars, and they blow up at around about 3,000. But the projected ACT-POL constraints will go all the way down the silk damping scale in the EE. And so we'll be able to really, again, have a much better lever arm, have a much better constraint on all the primary parameters that we would constrain with the temperature as well. An example of this is, again, if we think of the estimated primordial power spectrum that I showed you earlier that I did with temperature data, if we now look at the constraints that we get, so this is just temperature, the polarization data on E as it stands, ACT-POL will really nail down that EE power spectrum. And so we'll be able to put really strong constraints, for example, on any crazy deviations from a simple primordial power spectrum. Okay, so hopefully in this brief talk, I've told you about ACT. There are other small-scale CMB experiments you should take a look at, like the South Pole Telescope, based, unsurprisingly, at the South Pole. I've discussed why CMB data analysis is really important, because it's the only way we have a handle on how to separate all these interesting, complicated, and sometimes dirty cosmological models from one another. And I've hopefully described some of the exciting work that we're doing and our outlook for the future. So hold your horses for ACT-POL, and thank you very much.
Could I just ask about this axion isocurvature slide that you were going
Sure.
through very quickly? So if I want to think about like a QCD axion with a gut scale or Planck scale decay constant, I thought that was still consistent, but you seem to be, so is that over to the right?
These are ultralight axions. These are much lighter.
So you wouldn't, there wouldn't be any interesting improvement on bounds for those sorts of axions, say for the QCD axion?
Not given the data that we're looking at, no.
Because there are constraints there for isocurvature. I mean, as you're discussing here.
Exactly, but I think...
But those aren't going to get better, that's the point? Right.
Whereas we're allowing
this
to be...
But why are you only focusing on these ultralight things at, 10 to the minus 28? Is it because that's where the improvement is going to be?
Well, it's... So we're asking a kind of different question. We're saying, what if you're allowed to have a kind of mixed model where you have standard dark matter, but you also allow for some fraction, mm-hmm. rather than just saying, I want the axion to make up all of my dark matter. Mm-hmm. So in a sense, we're interested in a different question, but the scales in which you get a lot of interesting information here is this mass range. I mean, QCD axions are interesting, but as Dottie said, then you have to assume that they're making up all the dark matter.
Okay, thank you. So do you also get some constraint on alpha from ACT? Because here you quote the...
Yeah, so this is... So exactly. So that these are the results that we're putting out soon using ACT. We have some constraints. You actually get a lot of information from lensing rather than just, ACT and ACT lensing as well. But it's in that extra regime, where Planck already has given us some good constraints, but also we're adding just a little bit, slightly fewer L's, sort of at about L of whatever, 2,000, 2,500 that you get information as well.
Other questions? Okay, so let's thank again.
Thanks.
Speaker.